I'd like to call the Transportation Finance Division to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Jody, I see you were reading the minutes. Whether you approve, we have 2 minutes for March 26th and April 15th.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the approval of minutes from March 26th and April 15th. They are both excellent minutes.
Thank you. Representative Doty has moved the minutes. Any questions or corrections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? The minutes are approved. Today we have a presentation on congestion management, and we have people who came from afar even to present it. And I just would like to, for the members that are not on the committee, we do have a lot of committee members, but we also have several other committees going on, and they happen to be a tax committee and a finance committee, and some of our members are on those committees, and you see people coming back and forth, unfortunately. So that's where we're kind of at, and we're just thankful that we do have a quorum, and we're thankful that we can have this presentation. The presentation's on congestion management, and Mr. Todd Apple is a transportation solutions leader from a global IBM, and he makes this presentation throughout the country and I believe even the world. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Apple.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I actually didn't come from too far away, all the way from Chicago. So that wasn't really but I worked for 10 years in Europe focusing on road charging and intelligent transportation solutions. And what I want to spend a brief time talking about is challenges that transportation policymakers are facing around the world and some of the innovations that they're implementing to address those, specifically in the area of road charging and transportation information management. I'll talk about some projects that IBM has done in Stockholm and London and Singapore, but a range of other case studies that we haven't been directly involved in.
Mr. Apple, just excuse me a minute. You do have a packet that, as you're well aware, I think. Yeah, thank you. Mr. Apple?
Okay. What we're finding around the world, like in the U.S., there's just a huge growth in usage of roads. Many, many more people are driving as a result of economic growth, urbanization, increase in trade, people starting to work outside of city centers. And that's creating tremendous challenges for government because there are pretty strong limitations on how much you can grow infrastructure. It's really difficult to build more roads because of impact on the environment, resistance that communities have to exploiting land use, and many of the sources of revenue for infrastructure growth are actually static. So around the world, like in the U.S., there's heavy reliance on fixed vehicle registration fees and on fuel duties for payment for road infrastructure, and those fuel duties are typically not indexed to inflation. Is that better?
Okay. It's a somewhat better.
Is that better?
That's better,
okay.
Right.
Sorry about that.
I'm sorry, your name is pronounced Appel.
It's Appel. I wasn't going to correct you in public. Thank you for that. It is a foul. So these fuel duties, like in the U.S., typically aren't indexed to inflation, and as vehicles become more fuel efficient, the amount of money that's collected actually declines over time. So there's a problem here, which is leading to a mismatch between need and the possibility for supply. So what are policymakers doing? Well, there's lack of space, growing congestion, problems with pollution, affordability constraints, and inability to just build your way out of the problem. Now, building new infrastructure is still part of the solution, and we are seeing, like in the U.S., around the world, there's very significant investment in new transportation assets. But policymakers are also looking at other solutions to solve the problem of more cars and difficulty of building more space. So they're looking at alternative funding models, other ways of raising money, perhaps greater use of private capital, shifting to other ways of taxing for vehicle use, so a distance-based charge instead of reliance on the fuel tax. And also, they're looking at ways of actually managing the demand for roads and getting better use out of what's already there. So road charging or tolling is growing in popularity as a way to get people to shift to other modes of transportation or to impact when they drive. And there's also lots of innovation and investment around using information to get more use out of the infrastructure that's there. As far as road charging, as I said, it's growing in popularity, like in the U.S., around the world, as a way of managing demand, getting people to change their driving behavior, as well as a means of raising revenue. There's three types of road charging schemes that we're seeing around the world. One, the first one, this is the one we're most familiar with. It's very prevalent in the U.S. We call it corridor. It's just highway tolling. And here we're charging drivers to use a particular roadway. The main objective historically has been just to raise money to finance road building or to pay for the operations and maintenance of a road. Sometimes we see this done as a way of increasing driver choice or relieving bottlenecks. So we have the Hot Lane project here in Minnesota and a couple of other instances in the U.S. where you're actually putting a charge in order to give an option to a driver to use another road, and it also relieves a bottleneck for the people who stay on the road that's still free. This is very prevalent in the U.S., in Southern Europe, in the Nordic countries, in several countries in Asia and South America, and we see in place a range of funding models, both government-funded as well as public-private partnerships or concessionaires. That's new in the U.S., but in Southern Europe, the concessionaire model is actually the more common model as opposed to the government funding. Another type of road charging scheme is what we call area or cordon charging. These are the city congestion charging projects, which you may have heard of, that are existent in Singapore, London, and Stockholm already. Here we're charging drivers to enter into a city center or to drive within the city center. And the objective here is really congestion management and pollution reduction. You charge people for the right to drive, and it incentivizes them to come at a different time of the day or to use another mode of transport, specifically to reduce the number of people who are doing it. The third area is what we call network charging, where you're charging drivers to drive across a very wide road network. So the examples that are already in place are in Europe, and here we're charging trucks to drive either just on the motorways or on any road, and the price is actually based on a whole variety of factors like distance travel, time of day, number of axles, emission levels of the vehicle, and the concept is that you're actually tying what those truck drivers pay more directly to how they use the road for fairness reasons, in order to capture all the cost externalities of driving, like pollution, like damage to the road. There's truck driving schemes are gaining in popularity in Europe, and there's also some early explorations in the U.S., which I'm sure Lee Muniz will talk about in a minute. So I'll just go through some case studies of these three types of road charging schemes. For the corridor-based charging, I list here on the left side of the chart, which you can read for yourself, the cities and countries where this type of charging is most prevalent. What we see emerging as far as change in the future is that although the majority of these systems are meant for raising revenue, some are now shifting to more of a demand management focus. We were trying to impact actual driving patterns of vehicle owners. So there's a trend towards varying the price by time of day or level of congestion. So not only is it to raise revenue, but also to incentivize choices that travelers are making. And we're seeing a trend towards implementation of electronic open road tolling, the replacement of cash lanes where you're throwing money into a toll booth, into a bin, with use of transponders and cameras so that the traffic moves completely freely. It makes the cost of collecting the tolls much less, and it means that you can collect the money without actually impeding the flow of traffic. We're also seeing that as these highway systems grow, there's great interest in enabling interoperability. So if you have an account or a transponder to drive on one highway tolling network, you'll be able to use that same account if you're in another location. You don't have to change accounts. And in the U.S., that interoperability is done through systems that are based on proprietary technology, and it means that there's limitations in how far the interoperability can spread. In Europe, they actually follow an open standards model where government has set the standard for the frequency and the communication protocol between the transponder, and it makes it much easier for interoperability to spread widely. And you also have a competitive supplier market. We're seeing a linkage between tolling and other payment systems, so use of your tolling account to pay for parking or to buy food, a drive-through, et cetera. And we're seeing that as these systems grow, there's great interest in government in building shared services so that you're not creating separate back offices for each individual tolling system, and that way it's much more cost-efficient for government. Shifting to area or cordon charging, Singapore was the first example, or the first city to implement this internationally. It was first introduced in 1975. The objective was to reduce congestion and to maintain what they believed would be the optimal speed for traffic. The pricing strategy is to charge both for use on the ring road, which surrounds the center city, as well as to enter on a number of approach roads going to the center of the city. The price varies by type of vehicle, by specific location, and by time of day. And the charging technology is the use of transponders with a smart car that slots into a transponder, which deducts money that you've preloaded onto that car. The impact has been quite successful from the standpoint of reduced congestion. When it first rolled out in 75, traffic fell by 44%. The scheme was extended in the 90s to the center city, and traffic fell a further 15% with speed increasing. They're now talking in Singapore about extending this system to a wider road network, so it actually covers the bulk of the country, and vehicles would be detected, and the charging would be detected using satellite technology instead of transponders. London is another very well-known example of an area charging scheme. This was first implemented in 2003. You see on the map that's the central part of London. Initially, the area was just to the left of that green area, which is Hyde Park, and they extended it, or it's just to the right of the green area, and they extended it leftwards about a year and a half ago. Here you pay £8, which is about $16 per day, to drive within the center of London. There are a whole range of exemptions for residents, for taxi drivers, buses, motorcycles, and police and ambulance. The technology is based on cameras, not transponders, so you have 48 hours to pay. If you don't pay within that time and your license plate has been photographed by the system, then they send you a pretty hefty fine. Drivers can pay by phone, by text message, at retail networks. It's had a pretty significant impact on congestion. I mean, London is so congested that if you were new to London, you probably wouldn't notice that congestion is actually less. But if you were driving in the city before 2003, you would actually see a pretty huge impact. If the volume of vehicles driving in the charging zone fell by about 16%. And they're now talking about varying the charge by time of day and by specific area instead of having a flat charge in order to have a greater impact on driver choices. They're discussing extending it outwards beyond the central zone, and they've also implemented a low emission zone in a wider geographic area, which right now is enforced just for trucks, but in the next couple of years could be implemented for vehicles. This system has been operating for 5 years now, and they're now investing in a new back office system because they expect that the charging scheme is going to grow significantly in the future, and they're implementing a range of new charging policies, so they want to make sure that they have technology that will accommodate that growth. Stockholm is a more recent example of city congestion charging. This was first implemented in January 2006, and it was implemented initially on a trial basis. So they ran the scheme just for 7 months and then held a referendum of citizens who live in the central area of Stockholm as well as in the counties that surround Stockholm city center. The referendum was successful in the inner city of Stockholm. In other words, it had a majority approval vote, and the national parliament decided to extend the scheme, and it was relaunched in August 2007, and it's now a permanent feature. It's a cordon-based charging scheme, so you pay in order to enter the center city, whereas in London, you're charged not only for entering, but if you've originated your trip inside the center, you also pay. In Stockholm, if you start your trip inside the cordon, you don't actually pay. There's no area charge in Stockholm. You pay every time you cross the boundary, but there's a maximum charge per day, which is about €6. And the technology is based on cameras as well as transponders. Like in London, this scheme has had a very significant impact on congestion reduction and pollution. There's been 20-25% fewer vehicle passages per day in Stockholm city center, about 40,000 more mass transit users. 40,000 more people per day have been using mass transit, and emissions have decreased. Just to show you a little bit more about how Stockholm works, when you cross the cordon, your vehicle is identified either by RFID detectors, a detector transponder which is on the windshield, or if you don't have a transponder, your license plate is photographed by a camera, and drivers can pay through automatic direct debit accounts, whether they have a transponder or whether they're identified by camera. And if they haven't set up an account, it's possible to pay by internet, over the telephone, or at a network of 7-Eleven stores, which are pretty prevalent in downtown Stockholm. You can see here on this chart that when the system went live in January 2006, right away there was a significant reduction in the number of vehicles entering the center city. So the blue line is 2006, red is 2005, and the reduction in traffic held steady throughout the seven-month trial. And then when the trial period ended in August, right away the levels of traffic went right back up to where they had been previously. And then when the system was put back into force this past summer, the level of passages went down again to where they had been during the trial period. This chart shows you volumes of traffic spread over the day, and as you would expect, during the morning rush hour and the afternoon rush hour, those are the peak levels of traffic. And because the charge was higher during those peak periods, fewer people were driving in at that time, so the reduction in traffic was spread throughout the day. Public opinion, interestingly, was very negative before this trial began, and the way that the government was able to sell this to the public was by saying, well, we're just going to do this for 7 months as a trial, and you'll have a chance to vote after 7 months and decide whether you want to keep it. What the city found is that within a couple of months, when people saw that there were fewer cars on the street, that it actually took less time to drive if you chose to pay, that there was real benefits. And they actually had to redo the bus schedule because buses were getting to their bus stops faster than they had been previously because there were fewer cars on the road. So in general, people saw benefits in the scheme, and public opinion became favorable within a few short months. So there's an interesting lesson here, I think, for politicians on how to get public acceptance of these schemes. Doing it on a trial basis can be an effective strategy, as Stockholm demonstrates. Just shifting to network charging, I'll give a few examples here. As I mentioned earlier, that in Europe, network charging or distance-based charging thus far has focused on charging for trucks. Switzerland was the first country to implement this in 2001. In Switzerland, all heavy goods vehicles over 3.5 tons have to pay to drive on any road in the country. The issue for a number of Central European countries is that they're landlocked and there's very significant transit traffic. So the majority of trucks who pass through their territory, they're not actually paying commensurate to their use of the roads, because they might fill up their gas tanks in their home country or in one of the neighboring countries, so they'll pay fuel duty there, but then they drive on the roads in another country, do a lot of damage to those roads, cause higher levels of pollution, etc., but they're not actually paying directly for other things. So this system was a way of capturing some of those costs through a charge, which varies by time of day, by level of emissions of the truck, by distance in which they travel. Trucks are required to have a satellite based or GPS onboard unit in their vehicle, which tracks their travel, and they have a little card that slots into the unit and calculates their driving patterns, and they then bring that card into a central taxation office, and they stick that into a machine, and that's how they figure out how much money they owe. Austria has implemented a similar scheme in 2004. The difference here is that in Austria, you only pay the distance-based charge for driving on the major motorways. But other than that, the concept is similar. It's trying to capture from the heavy goods vehicles the full cost that are incurred from their driving in the country. It's not a satellite-based or GPS-based system, because they're not charging to drive on every single road. It's just on specific motorways, so a transponder or RFID-based system is more cost-effective. Germany, more recently, also implemented a national distance-based charging scheme for trucks. That was implemented in 2005, and like in Austria, that exists on every major motorway in the country, not on every road. I know in the U.S. There's now a significant interest in shifting to a mileage-based fee for vehicles, where you would shift all of the costs of driving, like vehicle registration, fuel duty, etc., shift that to a variable charge based on your actual driving pattern. There's early exploration of that in the U.S., and I've seen your slides legal. You're going to talk about a case study of that in the U.S. In the Netherlands, they've actually decided to implement exactly that kind of a project. They're finalizing their implementation plans this year, and that will be rolled out first for trucks in 2011, and then for all vehicles from 2012 afterwards. The concept here is to charge drivers for how they use their vehicles rather than just for the fact that they own a vehicle. So all existing road taxes and vehicle purchase taxes will be replaced by a per kilometer charge. And the idea here is not to necessarily collect more government revenue. Rather, it's to completely shift the way that revenue is calculated. So some motorists might pay more if they drive a lot, if they own high-polluting vehicles, if they drive on highly congested roads during peak periods. Those motorists will pay more, but other motorists might end up paying less than they currently pay because they drive less and they drive less polluting vehicles, etc. The Netherlands, like many, many countries around the world, is highly congested. They can't afford to build their way out of the problem. They have static fuel duty taxes. You know, all of the policy issues that I described at the outset are in force in the Netherlands, and so they're implementing this national scheme.
Excuse me, Mr. Appel, do you want questions now, or should we hold them?
Yeah, it's up to you. That's perfectly fine.
So the representative,
I can take it at the end, or now it's fine.
Representative Nelson, you want it now?
Yeah, I'll probably forget by the end.
Yeah.
When you talked about this per kilometer charge or mileage charge,
yeah,
and you were talking about based on polluting also, so cars that, say you own a Prius and you drive 100,000 miles a year, or if you own an SUV and you drive 10,000 miles a year, would they calculate in the gas mileage or the pollution of the carbon imprint footprint of those cars in that mileage, or is it just based pure mileage?
There'll be a fare for each road, which varies by time of day and by emission level of the vehicle. So it'll be a pretty complex fare chart, but if you know your vehicle, you'll be able to look up and see what you're going to have to pay to drive on a certain road at 7:30 in the morning versus noon or 10 at night.
Mr. Appel, is that GPS system or not? That's just based on a type of vehicle? And
well, it hasn't yet been implemented, but the concept is that it'll have to be through satellite technology, given that you're tracking vehicle movements throughout the whole country. And obviously in these projects there's significant concern and questions about privacy, but an area of research for companies like mine and many others is to figure out how to calculate driving patterns of vehicles without actually sharing that personal information with government. So you do the calculation on the device in the vehicle and you figure out how much that driver owes, and that's the only data that gets transmitted to government, as opposed to person X was on this road at 10 in the morning. And so there are ways that you can do that, but that's a big concern there, and they're figuring out how to overcome it. Just shifting away from road charging, and I'll be done in a couple more minutes. Another area of significant interest among policymakers, as I mentioned at the beginning, is to use information in order to get better utilization from the roads that we already have. So there's lots of data that's out there from loop detectors on the roads, from probes that are in vehicles, from toll gantries, etc. So we know a lot about what's actually happening on the road network. And the trick here is to actually use that information to be able to disseminate it to drivers so they can make more informed choices about when to drive, what roads to drive on, what transport mode to use, and also to use that data for the operators of the traffic management system so they can more effectively manage messaging signs and signals and ramp metering in order to direct traffic more efficiently. We've implemented one particular project in Singapore. We found that in Singapore they had quite a lot of real-time information on traffic conditions, but real-time quite often was too late, because by the time that information actually got to drivers or to the operators of the traffic management system, they didn't have enough time to really act on it. Or by the time a driver got to that particular point on the road, the conditions actually changed. So what you really need is not real-time information, it's the ability to predict what's going to happen in the future that you can proactively manage, and you can anticipate problems and proactively manage those. What we were able to do was using statistical methods, we developed a series of algorithms which we then applied to real-time data and then predicted in 15-minute increments what traffic conditions would be like on particular segments of the road over a 2 to 3 hour future period. And that traffic prediction data is now being incorporated into traffic operational management, like variable messaging signs, traffic signal timing, and ramp metering. We're now expanding those algorithms to be able to cover parts of the road network where you don't actually gather very good real-time data, but you know quite a lot about what's happening on the 2 or 3 roads next, you know, neighboring those where you do have the data, and so you can expand that and make some assumptions and be able to predict pretty accurately what's going to happen there as well. This data can also be used for traffic planning, to calculate road pricing, because in Singapore, I told you about the road pricing project, they want to be able to vary the charge on a dynamic basis based on traffic conditions, so this would enable them to do that. Just to conclude, what we're finding is that road charging, traffic information, this is an area of significant research and development and innovation among government policymakers and a whole range of private companies, and you know, traffic congestion problems are only getting worse, so there's a lot of thought being put into how to address these. Within my company, the areas that we're focusing on are, one, what we call innovative transportation pricing. So I gave you the example of the Netherlands, and we see that longer term, many countries and possibly states in the U.S. will want to shift the way people are charged for use of their vehicle, which is based more directly on their driving pattern. And so we're trying to figure out the most cost-effective technology solutions to operate those schemes. And we're also doing more work on traffic prediction and how best to incorporate that into traveler information systems and network management systems, and then to actually integrate that predictive traffic data into these road charging schemes for dynamic pricing and to inform drivers on what they might have to pay if they drive on road X so you can impact their driving pattern. So thank you for your time. That covers what I wanted to discuss. Happy to answer any questions.
We have questions.
Okay.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious about the public acceptance of this. You referenced some of the changes, but I'm wondering if there's a difference between the driver of the personal auto and, let's say, the trucking industry in terms of impact on them. I'm thinking particularly the trucking industry, the cost of doing business in a competitive environment, and whether that weighs in to their acceptance.
They didn't volunteer for these schemes. But, you know, in the countries that I mentioned, they already had to pay an annual fee, so they had to pay for a sticker that they put on their windshield. And so for some truck drivers, they're probably paying more, and others they might pay less. It just depends on their driving pattern. Over time, they now just calculate it as a cost of doing business. In Europe, you know, these projects are such that many of the truckers who are paying they're not residents in the country that's levying the charge, so the political dynamics are such that they don't have a voice in the decision in that country, and they only constitute a minority of the representatives. So they're not hugely popular among the truckers. Nonetheless, it's quite possible to get those passed. City congestion charging projects are very different, and those are very controversial politically, and many, many cities around the world, in the U.S. As well, they're looking at these kinds of projects, and it's difficult to levy a charge to use something which is currently free. That's always hard to do, and that's why I told the story of Stockholm as doing it on a trial basis and not giving citizens the right to vote. That seemed to be a formula for getting political acceptance.
And then, Mr. Chair, just on another subject, I'm always struck by how much we have to learn from other countries and how in some areas countries can be so far ahead of us. And this is more maybe comment to the committee than a question to the gentleman. And that is a kind of a sense that there might be in other countries a more open-mindedness for the public good, or at least a willingness to move in a new direction. What I'm just struck by is throughout your presentation I saw camera-based enforcement, a picture taken of the license plate. And here we've tried just to get one thing, which is the red light photocop, and that kind of sense of Big Brother watching has been resisting that. And yet I sense that that would be an essential piece of this, if this works, that that these cameras would be necessary and camera-based enforcement and pictures being taken would be essential for something like this to work.
Yeah, there are privacy concerns everywhere in the world, so the U.S. is not unique in that regard. I'll just give an example in Stockholm. IBM runs the system in Stockholm. We don't keep the images of the vehicles for very long. And by legislation, we're only allowed to photograph below the windshield. So we don't photograph the individual. It's just the license plate. And then that image gets dumped. So there are ways to protect people and to alleviate their concerns. I think in general, it may be different in Minnesota, but in many places around the world that cameras are very, very prevalent, and people don't actually realize that they're already being photographed quite a lot as it is.
Further questions? Scott, I have some. I think. Are these vehicles, most of the time, is that an aftermarket thing, the transponders, or are they the manufacturers putting some of the like transponders in the vehicle now?
Thus far, all of the transponders and GPS onboard units are aftermarket. That will change. Many automotive manufacturers are planning to have these devices embedded at the point of manufacture. Some car manufacturers already do that, but they're not devices that are compatible with the road charging standards that have been agreed by government authorities. But that will change over the next couple of decades.
Wilson Nelson.
So, like the the OnStar type thing, would that not be on the GM vehicle? That would not be compatible with this, or would that be?
Currently not. That doesn't have. You need specific software on the device to be able to do the things you would need to calculate a charge for driving. So those devices weren't designed to do that, but they could be. It's not that complex to do that.
Mr. Rappel, also, rights of way over there are pretty, they don't have the rights of way that we have, and especially in the cities. How are they, it appears to me some of this where they maybe put additional lanes or anything, how does that enter into this, the entire transportation system there now?
Every city is different because the topography differs. In Stockholm, a cordon scheme was quite easy to implement because the center city is surrounded by water, and all of the approach points are their bridges or major arteries. So you just put gantries on those, and no changes to the roadways were required. So it's difficult to answer. You have to look at the specific example.
In one of the parts that you spoke of, I didn't flag it, but you spoke of multi-use. Was that in the modes, or what do you mean by multi-use? I think I know what you mean, but how is it applied to the system when they're using it there? I've forgotten where it is.
It may have been when I referred to use of your tolling account or your transponder
right. For
paying for other things, which is becoming more common in the U.S., as well in those states that have tolling. So paying for parking at an airport or at parking garages, paying for food through a drive-thru. They just need a transponder detector
at their location so they can read your transponder, and you have data on that tag which identifies you, and they're able to take money out of your account.
Actually, was the area with linkage with other payment systems.
Yeah,
that's what you're speaking of.
Right.
Oh, Roxanne Medora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I see a state patrol officer in the back here, I'm wondering, how is this integrated with law enforcement? These sorts of multimodal uses, the ability to track a vehicle. Has law enforcement, have you seen their ability to respond, improve, and better traffic enforcement, that sort of thing?
Well, there's different dimensions to your question. I mean, thus far, there hasn't been much integration between these systems and law enforcement by design in order to protect privacy. In Stockholm, the police can request data from the charging system, but only under very, very special circumstances. And it's similar in London. So London has a quite extensive digital or video surveillance system, but it's a completely separate system from the cameras that are used to enforce the charge, and that's to alleviate concerns about privacy. At the same time, the fact that there's less congestion in the center areas, it makes it easier for police and other emergency vehicles to get around, and those vehicles don't pay the charge.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking specifically at the London congestion charge, the central city types. I see you have a 16% decline after all the technology went in. Do you have any idea what percent it would have dropped if they'd have just required a sticker on everybody's windshield? Do you compare low tech with your approach?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it really would have changed things, because the idea is that you pay directly per use, so you pay each day, and if you just buy a sticker, that would have to cover, you know, a very extended period of time. You could do that, but it wouldn't be as subtle of an impact on drivers. So you might buy for a whole month or a whole year, whereas here you have to decide each day, am I going to drive in London? And you still need a way to identify whether that person has paid. If there's a sticker, you still need to detect it. Here you just have a license plate and it checks on a system whether you're on the pay or less.
Representative Nelson?
As you were going through this here, and I wrote down a note here, when you were talking about Stockholm and the congestion pricing, have they increased park and rides in the perimeter of this? Like we have park and rides that we're doing here, and increased bus service to those so that people can choose to, if they live outside, park near and then take the bus into town? And
yes, that was a specific part of the congestion pricing project. So they spent a couple hundred million euro on a new park and ride, on expansion of bus lines, new buses, more train cars on the train lines, and all of that was actually implemented before the trial went into force. That's an absolute requirement for making these projects successful. If you want to incentivize people to take other modes of transport, you have to make it possible for them to do that.
Representative Moore.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Appel. If you didn't say anything, I was going to say something. I used to work at Hogue, Fenton, Jones, and Appel, a law firm, so I was going to help you out. I had your Mr. Appel, maybe to summarize from my point of view, on your page 7, you had three types, cordon, and network. Thinking about the geographic and population characteristics, if you will, of a Chicago or of a Minneapolis, St. Paul, and trying to get my head around, well, how might things be adapted? How might we look forward? So, for example, when you look at Stockholm, there are certain limited entry points, New York City being another one where maybe congestion pricing works well. Or in London, it's actually kind of interesting how they get around it by using the number of cameras. I can't put my head around how many cameras you would need to do that well. It seemed to be difficult to do a Stockholm or a London type of congestion pricing in a Chicagoland or a Minneapolis, St. Paul, unless you were willing to invest in cameras to do so, because you're not going to get the congestion points. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Depending on the topographical features of a city, you need more or less detection equipment. But that equipment lasts quite a long time and needs very minimal maintenance. So it's a one-time capital cost. And if you plan on having the scheme in operation for a long period, you have to do a detailed business case, and every situation is different. But it's not, it doesn't blow the business case having a more complex layout like Chicago would require. And there's lots of equipment that's already in place on the street, signals and other poles, and you can mount the equipment right on those without requiring new gantry infrastructure.
As I saw, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to turn also to the Netherlands, and I don't know the Netherlands population distribution well enough, but I think you mentioned it's a relatively congested country, and then I'm turning to Minnesota, and you mentioned kilometers, say, charging with other factors thrown in. Do you foresee that if you try to adapt a Netherlands-type approach to Minnesota, we'd be able to account for the number of miles one must drive? We heard on the House floor yesterday about people driving 100 miles just to go to their high school prom. And I'm worried about the number of miles one must drive to go to the movies or what have you in rural Minnesota versus the Twin Cities area.
Yeah, in the Netherlands, about 75% of the population lives in the southwest of the country. I actually lived there for 10 years, so I can tell you that. And the plan is just to vary the charge. So in the less populated areas, it'll be cheaper to drive per kilometer. And that's really it. And the point here is to capture the true cost of driving. Mm-hmm. And if congestion results in costs to society, which drivers don't actually pay for, so those driving in the congestion areas still pay more.
Mr. Chair, one more if I might. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pell, and I just lost it, so I will come back. I just lost it. I apologize.
While he's doing that, how is this a revenue neutral, or how? What do they do when they generate revenue?
The plan is for it to be revenue neutral. How it actually ends up, I can't guess. It's not in full operation yet, so we don't have data. They're not basing the charge on making more money. And it's quite complex because they want to impact things like congestion and pollution and that sort of thing, while also making it equitable for drivers. So how you actually set the price is enormously complex, and I'm sure that it will change during the first few years of the system in operation.
Well, in the capital cost, then, are they considering the construction of the infrastructure, or is that just for the technical part?
Both.
So that would be in their cost, then?
Yeah. And they haven't settled on their funding model yet.
Mr. Chair, if I might, it came back to me a senior moment, I suppose. Mr. Pell, I do remember, it was about corridor and tolling, if you will, if we could just simplify for a moment. Sensing, at least talking in the U.S., an aversion to tolling on existing roads as opposed to tolling or doing corridor type of funding for newly constructed roadways. What is your experience in terms of attempting to put a toll or a pass on an existing roadway and maybe the challenges of doing so?
It's very difficult. It's just like raising a tax or charging for something that used to be free. It's hard to do. Hot lanes are a good example of making that work because you're actually providing access to something which may not have been accessible previously because you were driving by yourself instead of with a number of people in the car. So there, it's been possible to sell that politically. Elsewhere, it's hard to do.
Griffin Mason?
I have a question. What this does is actually force people to make choices.
Griffin Mason, I believe maybe you can't. It's the mic. Yeah. Right.
Is that better?
Right.
Yes.
Is there information to show whether the amount of business conducted in these zones remained constant, or did people start taking their tours, business, etc., to the areas where they wouldn't be paying as much?
in the Stockholm, London, and Singapore examples, there have been very extensive studies done on that by business groups and government, and they've for the most part shown that these have been neutral for business. And it's obviously complex. There's some types of business or in certain neighborhoods that are impacted differently than others. And it's also difficult to isolate the causes of business success or failure because there's lots of other factors that play into that. So it's hard to do those studies. But in general, business was not negatively impacted in Stockholm, and some actually benefited. And London, it's a similar story. I can imagine that there would be cities where the circumstances are different and it might have a negative impact. It's something that you as legislators would want to watch pretty closely.
One other question. I see that you referenced Oregon. I presume, are you involved in that Oregon pilot study?
No, not currently. And I know, Lee, you're going to talk about the specific stuff.
Are there any further questions? If not, Mr. Appel, I really appreciate your coming. It's very interesting. I'm sorry that we don't have all our members. Maybe we could get you back. You never know.
I would be happy to do that. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Mr. Appel. Mr. Munich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lee Munich. I'm a senior fellow at the Humphrey Institute and director of the State and Local Policy Program at the University of Minnesota. I'm going to talk about congestion pricing in the U.S., and I guess I wanted to begin by saying that all of the innovative leadership doesn't exist in Europe, that we have some pretty innovative leadership in the United States, and particularly in Minnesota. The chair, representative leader, introduced a bill in 1994 calling for a study of a mileage-based system, not unlike the kind of test that I'll be talking about shortly in terms of Oregon. So I think that there's a lot of innovation that's going on in the U.S. We can learn a lot from these European models, and there may be some things that they've been able to do faster there because of things that the political and institutional problems are similar all over the world, so these kinds of changes are things that have to be thought about carefully, looking at, not just what might be the ideal situation, but what's the transition and what's the best way to get there. I'd like to begin by just saying a few words about the cost of congestion in terms of the burden that it places on our society. In the U.S., the financial cost of congestion by estimates of the Texas Transportation Institute are 3.7 billion hours of delay per year and 2.3 billion gallons of gas wasted, fuel and wasted annually. Almost $200 billion after accounting for unreliability and the system inventory costs, environmental costs across all modes. So it's a huge issue. It's one that we know about. It's one that has been chronic to our system. Congestion hurts family and civic life, impacting where people live and work, where they shop, how much they pay for goods and services. So, I think when we think about this problem and the need to address it, starting with the cost might be an important thing to do. I just wanted to take you through an analysis here of congestion. This happens to be a chart showing I-66 inbound outside the Capitol Beltway in the Washington, D.C. area on a Monday morning in 2007. We could put together similar charts for congested roadways in the Twin Cities area here as well, but this is one that I happen to have available. So if you look at this chart, you can start up at the in the upper left. That would be early in the morning. You can see there are maybe, this is the number of vehicles only a couple hundred vehicles initially traveling on the roadway early in the morning. They're able to travel at about 65 miles per hour. And then that continues. The speed is about the same till about 5 o'clock in the morning, when you're up to around 6,000, over 6,000 vehicles in the corridor. And they're still moving at a pretty good speed. By about 6 o'clock, as more cars enter, you start moving towards about 8,000 vehicles in this corridor. You can see as more cars enter, they slow down the overall speed, and by 6 o'clock, it's down in the mid-50s. By 7, it drops significantly. But as you can see, the number of vehicles are dropping here as well, and so that by 8 o'clock, there are actually fewer, fewer vehicles traveling in the same corridor at a much slower speed, down around 25 miles per hour. So what's happening here, it's not just a matter of speed and time delay, but there's also inefficiency in terms of this we're losing capacity in this urban corridor. So if starting at 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock there were some way to encourage people not some of the people not to travel in that corridor at that time, you could actually get more capacity out of this particular corridor. As one of my one person from Federal Highway Administration said, we're wasting the most expensive capacity and some of the most expensive roadways that we have in our urban areas. And so pricing if you were able to charge a price and vary that price in order to encourage just the right number of people to use that roadway, you'd be able to get a lot more efficiency out of it. Another example of where pricing is actually used is in California on the SR 91, which goes from in Orange County and Riverside County, and there is an express lane that is priced, and the price varies by time of day, right next to it there are unpriced lanes. During the rush hour, as you can see by this chart, the price lane is able to carry about 1,600 cars per hour, whereas the unpriced lane carries about half of that. So because of the pricing, they're able to move a lot more traffic through that. Just a couple of other statistics here. Todd Pell has talked about these. The delay in London dropped by 30%. The actual traffic drop was less, but around 16% or something like that. But the delay, the delay had dropped by 30% during the peak period. There was also additional reduction in bus delay, so that buses could move, more people could use the buses. And the road speed also increased. Same thing in Stockholm and Singapore. So a little less traffic, if you can do that using congestion pricing, can mean a lot less delay. In the U.S., there are a number of projects that have implemented various forms of congestion pricing. And I just want to make, one of the things that sort of is complicated when you talk about congestion pricing is that it is a tool where you can actually reduce congestion in a corridor. It's a congestion management tool, but it also raises revenue. So one of the questions is congestion pricing being used as a revenue-raising item, and if you want to raise revenue, you might use a slightly different approach than you would with congestion pricing. But congestion pricing is a very useful tool in terms of managing and reducing congestion in the corridor. So SR-91, I mentioned, in 1996, San Diego, California implemented a congestion management high-occupancy toll lane, very similar to or an earlier version of what now occurs on 394 in Minnesota. They used that for congestion management as well as funding improve transit in the corridor. Katy Freeway in Houston, Texas in 1998 had an HOV lane where they had too many people using it. It was they charge a toll if you're driving with two people or congestion price, and then if you're driving with three people, you go free. Sounds complicated, but it works, and they're able to make better use of that lane, and they're now exploring a more extensive use of hot lanes in the Houston area. Lee County, Florida implemented a different kind of an approach. They had a bridge which was congested during the morning peak periods and afternoon peak periods. So they were already charging a toll of $1, and they said, well, let's reduce the toll to 75 cents in the off-peak periods. And it turns out there were a lot of senior citizens and others who didn't have to travel during that time, and so they said, I'm going to, you know, take advantage of this lower price, and so they were able to shift people out of the peak period by that pricing mechanism. And it shows how it works. It also demonstrates that, you know, sometimes people think that everybody that's traveling during the peak period has to travel during that time, and there are a lot of people that don't. There's a lot of discretionary travel out there. They might be able to shift their time. They might be able to arrange their trips a little differently. So that price signal is something that works and helps and can make the whole system work more efficiently. I'll talk a little bit more about the I-394 MinPass project in the Twin Cities that started in 2005. I-25 in Denver, they were competing with the Twin Cities to see who would go first. The Twin Cities beat them, and so they implemented a congestion management hot lane the next year. Portland, Oregon, I'll talk a bit about their mileage-based road prices user fee pilot project. And then finally, U.S. DOT's Urban Partnerships Agreements, where the federal government offered incentives for cities to implement congestion reduction strategies, and I'll talk a little bit more about that and the Minneapolis-St. Paul crisis. I believe Bernie Arsenault is going to discuss that too, so he'll discuss more of it. Let me start off by talking about the I-394 MinPass project. This project, many of you may be familiar with it, was approved by the legislature in 2003. In 2005 was implemented. The goals were to improve the efficiency, a better use of the HOV lane, which had about 50% capacity that wasn't being utilized during the peak, to maintain free flow speeds in the MinPass lane, to use the any excess revenues to improve the highway and transit in the corridor, and then to employ new technologies for pricing and enforcement. What happened when this was implemented, by a number of measures, congestion was reduced in the corridor. This one shows the miles of congestion on I-394, and that was reduced by about 50%. From the year before to when MinPass was implemented. Also, in terms of, there were surveys that were done to find out just what the perceptions of the public were, the people using the corridor. Among I-394 drivers, you can see there was a decline in fall of 2004, 37%. Felt 394 was congested, dropped 29% after the MinPass was implemented. During the same time, the 35W was used as a control group because gas prices were changing, other things were going on in the same time. As you can see, the perceptions of congestion on for people being delayed on trips on 35W increased from 33% to 39%. The MinPass toll users, 30% of the transponders are used on a typical day. I think there are about 11,000 transponders that are currently in use. The average user doesn't use them every day. They use them 2 to 3 times a week, which is an indicator that people value their time differently on different days. There are different types of trips, and there are a wide range of users. Usage tends to be higher among full-time workers, homeowners, people aged 35 to 55, people of higher income, and women. MnPass user satisfaction has been quite high. These are some of the indicators based on the survey of MnPass users. Also, there's some concern about how this might affect people of different income groups. I mentioned that people of higher income tend to use it more, but people of all income groups do use it, and people of all income groups think it's a good idea to do it. So it doesn't matter whether you're a lower income or a middle income or higher income person, people tend to think this is a good idea to do it. There was some concern when this was implemented because of the way the diamond lanes were going to be double striped, and this was the first time that there was a lane like this that was created where there wasn't a barrier separation, and so there were concern whether there'd be increased safety problems. And in fact, the year afterwards, there was a 12% decrease in crashes. So. At least there was no increase, and there was some decrease in crashes in the quarter. There are a number of enforcement strategies that are used. Some of the funding from the MnPass lanes goes to provide additional enforcement and technology so that the police officer can read and determine whether a person has paid as they pass the various tolling points, or pull them over if they're not. If they haven't paid and they're not carpool. Enforcement results have been, there's been a drop of about 50% in violations on I-394, 7% to 4% in the reversible section, which is barrier separated. People, might be a little bit harder to cheat in the diamond lane portion. It's dropped from 20 to 9%. During the same period, I-35W HOV lane increased from 23% violations to 33% violations. So they're filling up the 35W lane with cheaters, which is not necessarily a good way to do that. And one of the arguments is it's not just enforcement. When you're in a hurry and you see a lane, there might be a temptation to use it, and so this gives people a legal way to be able to use the lane. So the MnPass project is meeting most of its goals, significantly reducing congestion, increasing safety, and dynamic pricing and technology seems to be working well. The revenues are now meeting the operating costs, so they're not yet covering the capital costs. So there's no excess revenue that can be allocated to transit and other highway improvements, which some people hope might happen at some point in the future. There's currently a study which is near completion on a phase two project that might allow creating an additional lane in the corridor during the barrier separated portion to deal with reverse flow problems, and then also improving transit and land use planning in the corridor as well. So that study should be available in the next few months here, and probably by the next session we'll have something more to say about that. I'd like to say a few words about the urban partnership agreement. The federal government decided that they wanted to support projects that included congestion pricing and used transit improvements, other technology improvements, telecommuting as a way of reducing congestion. And the objective here was to do something in U.S. cities like they did in Stockholm and London. And in both of those places, they made significant investments in transit in conjunction with congestion pricing. So the federal government, USDOT, said we'll make an offer, come in with proposals. There were 28 proposals that were originally submitted. 5 were selected. The first one, New York, recently failed to meet their deadline for authorizing legislation. So they're giving up $345 million, which will now be reallocated to other cities. I understand Los Angeles is a serious contender, but there are a list of about 30 cities that are prepared to use this money since New York is not. Miami, Seattle, San Francisco and then Minneapolis, St. Paul were winners of this. And in the case of Bernie Arsenal, will talk more about this, but in the case of Minneapolis, St. Paul, it's $133 million. These are some of the things that are happening. I think I'll skip over this slide because Bernie will be talking about that. I would like to finally, though, say a little bit about the Oregon road user fee pilot. And this really is the idea that Chairman Leader proposed several years ago. But what they wanted to do was to, if we are at some point going to be moving to more of a mileage-based fee, Oregon wanted to explore how you might transition to that type of system. Oregon has many of the same problems we have here. The gas tax has not kept pace with inflation. Voters have opposed increase in the gas tax. And fuel efficiency of new vehicles, especially hybrids and alternative fuel vehicles, continues to increase, resulting in less taxes paid. Oregon's DOT launched a mileage fee pilot project in the Portland area in March of 2006. This project tested several aspects of charging a per mile fee at the pump in lieu of paying the state gas tax. Their pilot program included 280 pilot program volunteers in Portland. They had onboard mileage counting equipment added to their vehicles, which was paid for by the project. For a period of 1 year, volunteers paid a road user fee equal to 1.2 cents a mile and did not pay the gas tax. Two service stations in the Portland area were equipped with mileage reader devices, and the pilot participants were asked to fill their vehicles in these participating service stations when convenient. When refueling, the onboard mileage counter communicated with the mileage readers placed at the pump. So when the purchase was totaled, the gas tax was deducted automatically and the road user fees added automatically. So it basically used the same collection system we have here, but did it on a mileage basis. There were also some policy alternatives that were included in this test. Some of the pilot volunteers were charged more in a rush, or included in a rush hour pricing group to test the concept of varying the price to use the congestion management tool, and then future policy options that they would like to include if they move forward with this kind of a project is to charge a lower rate per mile for vehicles that achieve certain fuel efficiency for motorists that avoid the rush hour zones or for those participating in other environmentally friendly situations. Very similar to the kinds of things that Todd talked about in what they're doing in the Netherlands. That's the end of my presentation. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Munich. Questions? You probably did too good a job. This is really, I think the committee needs to review this fairly often, and perhaps, well, not perhaps, but I'm sure that's going to be coming up. We're kind of light as far as members, that's the problem. But appreciate Representative Nurse Nelson.
I guess the question I have is on the Oregon study. How long has that been in effect there?
It was a pilot test for a year. It's been completed. They basically determined that this could work, and so they're now going back to the legislature to find out whether they want to move towards that kind of a system. So they've proved that the concept that this could work, and if they implemented this on a statewide basis, this would be a way in which they would do it. So it was, but again, it was just a pilot to demonstrate how the technology might work and how people would respond, and if they did it in this way, that it could be accomplished. Again, this is, it may be, if the kinds of technologies that are being used in Europe are probably what we might ultimately do. But if we move towards this kind of a system, it's how do you shift from a gas tax to a mileage-based system, and it may start off with some sort of hybrid system, hybrid in the sense of two types of systems, and you pay one versus the other, or some people are, you know, there might be some choices in terms of doing it. So so this is, you know, I think we've been able to learn a lot from this. I believe the legislature, you know, has authorized a mileage-based study in Minnesota, too. So, you know, we'll be able to learn from that as well. And there's also a couple of national commissions that are advising moving towards this kind of a system on a long-term basis. So, you know, I'm sure that this will be a topic of considerable discussion over the next next few years here in the nation and in Minnesota as well.
Representative Doherty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little unclear. The slide that's talking about acceptance at all levels of income, was that an actual survey of people that were using MPAS, or is that just a survey based on income?
No, that was a there was a survey that the Humphrey Institute coordinated with a survey research firm where we randomly selected people in the corridor as part of the evaluation, and it was people in the corridor that some of them were drivers, some of them were, you know, only a small percentage of those were MinPass users, because it's still most of the people are not MinPass users. So even though they're not using that, they think it's a good idea for that to happen. And then we segmented it. We asked them about their income level, and we segmented the analysis by income level. So this is not, they found similar results when they've gone to other places. People don't necessarily, you know, if they have other options, they don't necessarily see it as, you know, inequitable that some people might use it more. And the fact that they have the option to use it from time to time, they see as a benefit. So that's not inconsistent with what we found in other places.
And, Mr. Chair, do you know off the top of your head what the dollar amount is for considered low income that was used in
it? $50,000. This is a relatively high income corridor. So it was $50,000 low income, $50,000 to $125,000 middle, and then $125,000 and over.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Munich.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Arsenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me quickly get this set up. Okay, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bernie Arsenault. I'm the director of the Office of Traffic Safety and Operations for MnDOT. And we just heard about some of the international and national activities in the area of congestion mitigation and innovation and tolling and congestion pricing. And now I'd like to cover some of the traditional and more innovative approaches that we've actually implemented here in Minnesota and that we're looking to in terms of managing the traffic that we have in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. The Regional Transportation Management Center offers us a unique venue to address the issues that are facing us in terms of mobility and safety in the metro area. We're able to combine the freeway operations group, the arterial operations, and just as a definition, arterial would be the non-freeway, where more intersections that have signals, some that don't, but at-grade intersections. And then we also bring in the MnDOT maintenance, the Metro District MnDOT maintenance dispatch, and the State Patrol dispatch. So we're able to work together in order to address many of the issues that are facing us, including the incident management pieces. Our objectives when we talk about the way we handle traffic is to really maximize the number of vehicles that the freeway can handle. It's to minimize congestion and obviously improve safety in doing that. We also, though, want to provide traveler information and provide the users with information that can maybe allow them to choose an alternate route and as a result, reduce some of the impact that their trip would cause on the system. Also, we have what we call the FIRST program, Freeway Incident Response Safety Team, that provides aid to stranded motorists. And that may seem trivial, but those of you who drive the freeway systems often recognize that when there's a car stopped on the shoulder, it can have a significant impact to traffic and safety. So the tools that we use with our freeway operations are pretty dramatic. We've got 430 cameras across the system. We've got 4,500 loop detectors, and of course those loops help us identify what the levels of traffic are, the numbers, the volumes, and also the congestion itself. The freeway incident response safety team. We also have the 511 traveler information, which we continue to enhance and make more user-friendly. Ramp meters, changeable message signs, 107 of those across our system, HOV lanes, and also KDEM, which provides full-length traffic information on every 10 minutes during the peak period. Exciting effort is that we have, or position that we're in right now, is that we are really probably the only major metropolitan area in the U.S. that has a full build-out on their freeway system in the Twin Cities metro area of our freeway management system. As of June, we'll be completing the I-35E and I-35W extension to the north, and that will fully build out our freeway system, which leads us then to our next area that we need to concentrate on, and that is the arterials. And so we in the metro area currently manage about 670 signals, and of course the timing is critical for improving flow and maximizing mobility and so forth. Across the state, we've got about 1,400 signals. As a part of our urban partnership agreement, we'll be extensively implementing an arterial management system on Trunk Highway 13. That will include 17 cameras, 6 changeable message signs, and that will be linked up with the same fiber cables that we have on the freeway system. We're also looking at another program, and that's called our integrated corridor management system on the Trunk Highway 7, Trunk Highway 55, and I-394 corridors out on the western suburbs. Signal optimization is an important part of this. It's one of those areas that doesn't get the attention sometimes that it needs, and it has a high benefit cost. So we have been, over the past couple of years, really looking at some of these arterial corridors to improve the signal timing so that we can get traffic through those corridors more quickly. Talked a little bit about the FIRST program, and again, I think this is a program that folks don't really recognize the true value that this provides. This really focuses on the non-recurring congestions. These are incident-based congestions that can be anywhere from someone running out of gas or having a flat tire to a major shutdown of our roadways. They help provide traffic control in conjunction with the State Patrol and our metro maintenance folks. We have recently expanded that now to cover the whole metro area, as you can see by this illustration. So there are some other areas we want to cover, but that will come as volumes increase on the other corridors. This has been a very positive program for us, and we realize benefits on the system because of the work that they do. Ramp meters, we get a lot of sometimes negative attention, but they do provide us with a great way of managing the oncoming traffic to the freeway system. They've been around for a long time. Minnesota has implemented this tool extensively across our system. We've got 190 that sometimes operate in the AM peak and another 208 that sometimes operate in the PM peak. The point of the ramp meters that I think that some folks don't fully understand is that we only operate them when our loop detectors and other technology in our system indicate that congestion is about to occur. By implementing the ramp meters, we're able to delay the congestion that otherwise would occur by the oncoming traffic. We pace that oncoming traffic in a way that doesn't just flood the system and thereby cause a backup that really takes a long time to get rid of once it's occurred. MinPass and the HOV lanes, Lee talked a little bit about it on the 394 corridor. That's been in effect since 2005. It's been a very, I think, positive, innovative way of managing traffic along that corridor. We've seen, as Lee talked about, the public reception of that has been quite positive, and we're implementing an additional MinPass lane as a part of our urban partnership agreement that I'll talk about in a little bit on the I-35W corridor south of the Minneapolis area. Again, we talked a little bit about the I-394 MinPass. That is dynamically pricing a lane for single occupancy toll users, and it provides an option for those folks, and in so doing, those that choose to utilize the single occupancy toll lane or the MinPass lane relieve a bit of the congestion that occurs on the general purpose lane. So it is a positive outcome. The technology that we have in place on the system enables us to monitor the traffic so that when it does begin to increase, we're able to increase the toll as well, and that will enable us to provide that guarantee of a 50-mile-an-hour trip along the corridor.
Excuse me, Mr. Yes. Arsenault. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick question on this slide, Mr. Arsenault, so I hope to stop here on point number three, where revenues exceed operating costs. Where does that excess then get allocated?
To the Mr. Chair and Representative, that gets allocated to the capital cost on the 394 corridor.
Mr. Arsenault, I believe it's correct. It's specific to the corridor where they generate the money. It's
because
over
that's
the
correct.
System, right?
It's dedicated to the 394 corridor. In terms of transit advantages, we work very closely with Met Transit, Met Council, and Met Transit on enabling transit to be enhanced wherever we can. As a part of the UPA, we're going to do that, but also, you know, one of the things that we take a little bit for granted here in the Twin Cities area is our bus-only shoulders. We've got about 250 miles of bus-only shoulders. And as I understand it, that's about 10 times more than all the other bus shoulders in the nation. So we are a leader in that area. The HOV and hot lanes provide a benefit for transit as they get to use those for free as well, but with a guaranteed trip of 50 miles an hour along those corridors when they are the hot lanes. Park and ride lots, we've got those extensively around the system. And then the HOV ramp meter bypasses provide an area for queue jump for the transit vehicles. Integrated corridor management, I talked a bit about this. We were one of eight urban areas that were selected for this program. It looks at the parallel corridors in an area, and in this case it's 55, 394, and Highway 7. And the idea here is that we want to provide information to the user so that they can pick the best route for them on that day. Given incidents, given congestions, or other things, it may be quicker for a vehicle to defer from the 394 route over to one of the other routes to get to their destination. And so this will incorporate some of the ITS technology in order to give the users the information they need to make those choices. Another area that we're looking at very heavily right now is this idea of low-cost, high-benefit congestion and safety mitigation projects. Recognizing that it's very difficult to build out the system, the major expansion projects are expensive and also just hard to implement, and so we're looking at more targeted investments in the non-traditional type projects. And we've got some examples of that in the 394 auxiliary lane at Highway 100, I-94 at McKnight and Century Avenue, and then also Highway 7 down south of 394 on Highway 100. Those were three really important relatively minor projects that had a huge impact on congestion in the metro area. Just as an example, Highway 7, It reduced congestion in that area along Highway 100 from 6 hours to less than 1 hour a day. And the way we did that was by utilizing the shoulder area to put in a through lane that didn't previously exist. Now, we had to do some geometric manipulations to do that, and it didn't fully meet our standards. But what we found is that by adding that lane to a lesser degree than our full build-out standards, we were able to reduce injury crashes by 70% and property damage by 30%. And so we see that as an extremely effective safety solution in addition to the congestion that it reduced as well.
Mr. Ashner, are those 11 or 12 foot lanes, or are they narrow, or is that a 10 foot lane?
Mr. Chair, members, we would not go down to a 10 foot lane in this area. I believe there is an 11 foot lane out of those three. But those are the things we're looking at, is narrower lanes down to, on the freeway system, maybe 11 feet, like we utilized on 94 between 280 and 35W, but also using up the shoulders, that real estate that we have out there to carry traffic during congested periods, and that really is the point of our urban partnership agreement project that I'll talk about in a minute. So that leads us to a whole new area of congested content.
Excuse me, Representative Fedora?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning. I'm wondering, I'm seeing here, this seems to be the chronic problem, as I hear about a lot of these projects, is this overpass that we have. And actually, I see here when you added that third lane, it came right out behind the overpass. So we still have all of that congestion leading up to that, and I have that situation on 77 North, which is one of the projects that you're looking at for this. Have you investigated the cost of looking at these overpasses? And integrating those is also part of the solution, perhaps widening that? I mean, what is involved in doing that? Because over and over again, when we look at these projects, that seems to be where the bottleneck is. The lanes are spread out as far as they can to stay within the confines of that overpass. But in order to fix it, it's going to mean to remodel that. So have you been looking long range at addressing this with these overpasses, and do we have a cost idea for that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Representative Medora, yes, we look at all of the aspects of the geometrics and the cost of improving those geometrics when we look at both the full build-out and also the smaller congestion mitigation projects. And so sometimes those bridge costs get very high, and so it's better for us to try and look at the geometrics and see if there isn't a way that we can fit a lane through, maybe to a lesser standard than our full build-out, but ones that we believe are safe based on the data that we have. So these tend to be more of an interim solution until we can get at the bigger project.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask?
My door.
So the bigger project, let's say 10 years down the road or whatever that figure may be, would be to be looking at addressing these overpasses. And have we put in new standards for building these overpasses so that, again, in the future, should we need to expand a lane, we're not down to a two-lane space on that?
Thank you, Arsenal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Medora, yes, in fact we do. We look out at future volumes, anticipated volumes, when we make those decisions.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not looking at all here for a detailed road-by-road explanation, just a general statement. When these roads were constructed, what percent or what ratio do we have where the shoulder is constructed to handle traffic if we decide to just move lanes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doty, very few of the miles of our system have shoulder that is capable of handling traffic. Now, there's an exception to that, and that's those bus-only shoulder lanes that I talked about. But those also aren't built necessarily to the way that we would build them to handle traffic. So there are some modifications that need to be made when we try and utilize that real estate, as we're going to do on the 35W UPA project. So that leads us then to the congestion management planning study projects. We took a pretty extensive effort at looking at the whole metro system for types of projects that were non-traditional in nature, ones that we could go in there, make some smaller changes, and have a great deal of impact on the mobility and safety of the freeway system in the metro area. We identified 19 projects as a part of that for a total cost of $60 million. Now, we're right now working on those very aspects of these projects that I just talked about. You know, we're looking at experience that we have with 11-foot lanes and experience that we have without shoulders or with limited shoulders. And so we're trying to identify what the impacts are of making these changes, and ultimately we, of course, want to provide the highest benefit for the user. And we do not want to jeopardize safety in any of these projects. So that's what we're looking at right now. But we have identified these 19 projects that we believe would be a benefit to the area. just a little bit on an urban partnership project right now. We were, as Mr. Munich talked about, one of the five metro areas that were awarded an urban partnership agreement project. We're getting $133 million from USDOT. It's along the 35W corridor south of Minneapolis, and our centerpiece probably on this is the dynamically priced shoulders, and I'll talk just a little bit more about that in a minute, but there is a significant transit enhancement that comes out of this, especially to Minneapolis, where on 2nd and Marquette Streets, we're going to build out and add a second transit lane. Now, those two transit ways in Minneapolis have tended to be a bottleneck. By adding this additional lane, we will be increasing the capacity for transit vehicles by 3 times. So we'll be tripling the amount of buses that can handle. That will greatly reduce the time that's needed in those corridors and make transit a more desirable modal choice. So that's important. Plus, we're building out some park and rides, adding some buses. So there's a really important transit benefit that UPA will provide. And we've also got a pretty neat telecommuting project as a part of this. We're going to be looking at seeing if we can remove some of those trips from that corridor as a part of the UPA. So there are three major parts to our UPA hot lane. The first is south, where we now have an HOV lane. We'll be converting that lane to a MinPass lane, a charge lane. We're going to have to do some changes in those areas in terms of the highway infrastructure, but we'll be adding the technology in order to do that, and it will look much like the 394 MinPass lane.
Rep. Ken Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you convert these HOV to hot lanes, similar to 394, if there's a excess funds here, well, those excess funds, because it's part of the urban partnership, would they be part of the urban partnership, or would they stay on this corridor like 394's excess funds are to help enhance this corridor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes. Any revenues, again, would be dedicated to this corridor.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members. Okay, so the south third is going to be the conversion of the HOV to hot lane, like 394. The middle third is going to take the HOV lane that's being constructed as a part of the Crosstown project and converting that to a MinPass lane as well. And then the final piece, and again, this is the centerpiece of our project, is going to take the shoulder real estate area and convert that to a through lane during, it'll be an HOT lane, MinPass lane, during the congested period. When traffic builds and we see congestion is going to form, we'll open that shoulder lane, and it will be on the left side, so it'll be a continuous lane along the left side from Burnsville all the way up to Minneapolis. The shoulder lane will open up during congested periods and provide that extension to Minneapolis so that we can guarantee, as we do with MinPass, a 50-mile-an-hour or better trip along that MinPass lane all the way from Burnsville to Minneapolis. And that we expect will open the end of or September of next year. And another important part of this, or an interesting and exciting part of our UPA proposal, is that we will have lane control signals all along that corridor. This is an illustration to try and show what we can accommodate with these lane control signals. About every half mile, we're going to have a bridge that has over every lane a 5x5 full matrix color sign that can simulate or can actually illustrate any kind of traffic control device. What you see here is an advisory speed message that tells traffic that you ought to be thinking about slowing down. And the reason we're doing that is to try and meter lanes similar to what we do with our ramps to slow them down before they get in a congested area, and that will ultimately reduce the congestion that would occur. But these lane control signals can also be used for incidents. As we use up the shoulder, we need to be able to manage incidents such as crashes and things like that so folks aren't surprised as they approach them. So we'll be able to close off lanes with these lane control signals, provide access for emergency vehicles, but most importantly, I think, is let traffic know that there's something different up front, and they need to be careful about that, and we think that will dramatically increase safety. We've got experience with lane control signals. As you approach the tunnel on 94, we found them to be extremely effective in helping us manage those incidents.
Representative Nelson?
So as part of this and part of the using the shoulder, are you going to be increasing the highway helpers or the first program during congestion, have more of those on this stretch of road so that if you got a shoulder and that the car broke out on that shoulder and you're going to open it up for traffic, you're going to have that car get out of there. Are we going to be increasing the patrolling of the first?
Mr. Arshino?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, yes. As we do with the 394 in-pass lane, our first vehicles do run that prior to opening those lanes, so we'll know whether or not something's there. As a part of the UPA, we'll also, because of all of these lane control signals, we'll need to monitor heavily this corridor through our cameras and such to make sure how it's operating so that we can utilize these lane control signals to their greatest extent.
Mr. Arsenault, if you use those lane control signals where they don't have them now, say you have an incident in one of the lanes, would there be a problem with crossover lanes for the traffic merging before when they see this sign where you now you have a sign and you know everybody's going to try to get in the other lane? Or I'm sure you addressed that, but wouldn't that be a problem?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We have to be careful about how we inform motorists to make that move. With these every half mile, we'll be able to provide them with advanced messages, so with enough time to safely make those moves to the alternate lane. So that's really a high point, I think, of our proposal under the UPA. And that's just a brief summary of some of the things we're doing here in the metro area. And some of these technologies are also being distributed across the state to some of the other urban areas and our recreational corridors. So there's a lot going on in Minnesota right now.
Are there any further questions? Representative Mason?
Mr. Chair, I have two questions. One is, I remember the controversy over the radio, 88.5, a while back. So is there definite proof that that truly is that important? I know I use it, but...
Mr. Arsenault?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, we have found that to be extremely valuable in providing information to the public when there are incidents. Many folks use it for their daily commute. So when we have a significant incident on the system, we know that the KBEM radio provides information to users so that they can take alternate routes, and ultimately that minimizes the congestion that occurs. So it's an extremely high benefit for us to have that.
Thank you.
Mr. Arsenault, there was a time when some legislators wanted to get rid of the highway helper. Is that a problem if you still have enough or you have a lot of turnover? How many units do you use?
Mr. Chair, right now I believe we have 12 or 14 units. We have 10 routes for the highway helper or the freeway incident response safety team. And, you know, when that came up, what you referenced about, you know, this idea that maybe we shouldn't have a freeway incident response safety team, we were able to bring out the data. And because of the infrastructure that we have, we're able to show the impact that our freeway incident response safety team has on managing congestion and incidents throughout the system. And it has an incredible benefit cost. For the money that we put for it, we get a high benefit out of those dollars. And so those issues about removing it have gone away. And as part of our operations plan recently, where we looked at our operations, we actually expanded that 2 and 3 years ago. So we're pleased that people are recognizing the value that the highway helpers provide on our system.
Well, we had legislators that were towing operators. That's where that started. But there's a change here now. But the other question I had related to that, again, what are their hours of operation? Are they nighttime, also after 6, or just peak hours?
Mr. Chair, I believe their hours are from like 5:15 or 5:30 in the morning all the way through to, I believe, 8 o'clock or 8:30 at night. And then they're also on for 8 hours on Saturday and Sunday.
Any further questions? Not. Thank you very much, Mr. Arsenault.
Thank you.
For the members of the committee, we have some business to take care of. Yes, and that's Representative Morrow. Do you want to explain it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you members, you have Senate File 3502. This is a bill that we already heard in committee. It's called an Implement the Husbandry Bill. It is about farm equipment and bridges. This language was included in the omnibus bill that we passed off the House floor yesterday. The reason that you're seeing the bill in front of you today is in the hopefully unlikely event that there is a veto of the omnibus bill, we still need to move the Implement of Husbandry Bill in order to avoid a run-in, if you will, a conflict with the federal government for being in non-compliance and try to stave off a potential audit by the federal government, which is requiring us to take action regarding bridge liability and bridge exemptions. So, members, I'm hoping to move this, the Senate File 3502, Mr. Chair, to the Finance Committee just to be prepared if we have to move on the floor with a separate bill.
And for members of the committee, we do have a quorum. So, Representative Morrow moved to insert the Senate, or the House, the Senate language, Senate File 3502 into the House file. Is that a, or the reverse?
No.
No,
this is a
substitute. Okay. Your motion is to substitute Senate File 3502 for House File 3805.
Yes,
that's
Mr.
Chair. We can just move it.
I was just going to move it, Mr. Yeah. Chair.
Any further questions for the motion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? The motion passed, and we'll be moving Senate File 3502 to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think there are no further business to come before the committee. I appreciated the presentations we had, and I hope the committee did, because I think it helps us a lot for future thinking.
Absolutely.
Again, thank you very much, and the meeting's adjourned.